Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. Today I'm talking with registered dietitian Jackie Silver, who joins me to discuss nutritional approaches that are helpful for neurodivergence, why people with ADHD and autism are often the targets of wellness and diet culture, the kinds of wellness culture messages she's gotten as a person with a disability, and why the advice to cut out gluten for autism is so harmful. Behind the paywall, we get into why ultra-processed food consumption doesn't cause autism and why cutting out these foods doesn't quote-unquote cure it, the harmful discourse around autism and ADHD in the culture right now, why it's harmful to categorize foods as good and bad, and lots more. This episode is cross-posted from my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness, and I thought it would make a perfect conversation for Food Psych as well. I can't wait to share it with you right after these messages. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you've gotten something out of the conversations here, please consider supporting the podcast for a few bucks a month. The best way to do that is by signing up as a paid subscriber on Substack at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. If you do, you'll also get extended interviews and bonus segments, ad-free episodes, subscriber-only essays and Q&As, and more. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com and enter your email address. And thank you so much for your support. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Jackie Silver. You're a dietitian specializing in neurodivergence and disability, and I really want to dig into all of that. But first, I'd love to know a bit about your background. How did you get into doing this work in the first place? And I'm curious if there was ever a personal connection for you or a personal history with diet and wellness culture that maybe led you to want to study nutrition in the first place.
It goes back to since I was a child, because I was born with a condition that affected my left leg. Very rare vascular condition. And so my whole life, I grew up doing physical therapy and going to osteopaths or massage therapists to make sure that I was as functional as possible. And I've always loved exercising, and exercise has always been a part of my life. To me, it's a way to make sure that I'm, you know, not in pain and mobile and independent. And so I was always interested in health, nutrition, exercise. And then when I was looking into different career paths, I just felt that nutrition would be a good fit for me because, you know, there's no like physical involvement in it. Like being a physical therapist, I think would have been too difficult for me. You could involve a lot of creativity, and there's a lot of different ways that you could work in nutrition. So my first undergraduate degree was in kinesiology, which is where I got that exercise piece, which I'm still very passionate about. And then my second undergraduate degree was in nutrition, because growing up in Toronto, Canada, you had to have a Bachelor of Nutrition. And then I did a master's of health science and nutrition communication, which included the 10 months of dietetic internship rotations to become licensed. And one of my rotations there was with Special Olympics Ontario. So I got to work with athletes with intellectual disabilities, which was really awesome. I did cooking classes and nutrition workshops for them, and I loved interacting with the athletes. And it was there that I started to see there's a really big need to support this community, because I was the first nutrition student that they had ever had. And it's a huge organization. And so then I finished my master's degree about 2 weeks before the COVID lockdowns in 2020. And I found myself with all this extra time on my hands because I was at home and the job market was not great. So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to start my practice and see what happens. I have the time, so I'll do it. Like, I had studied for the licensing exams for Canada and the US. And then I decided to start my practice. And I originally wanted to focus on people with physical disabilities. So like, I was interested in nutrition for spinal cord injury, that type of thing. But that part of my niche just never took off for some reason. And when I was creating a profile on this healthcare directory, they had like a list of quote unquote conditions, and they had autism and ADHD. So I kind of naively checked that off because I had, you know, my experience with Special Olympics athletes. And then I started getting all these requests to work with autistic kids, autistic adults, or adults with ADHD. There was a need here and nobody else was really filling that need. So I decided to go all in, and I've done a bunch of extra training to be more confident in working with this community. And it's been really rewarding and fulfilling.
I want to talk more about nutritional approaches for neurodivergence in a moment, but I'm also curious, like, for your personal history, just kind of going back and thinking about your disability and, or, you know, condition. And I know that you ended up having your leg amputated, right? I'm curious to kind of hear more about that journey and whether you ever felt pressure to like fix it with food, especially when you were dealing with a vascular condition younger and going to physical therapy and sort of in those environments where maybe people were encouraging. I don't know if you experienced that, but I know certainly for me, like when I've been in environments that are sort of not really alternative medicine, but like a little bit alternative adjacent, like physical therapy or massage therapy and things. Well, that's more alternative, I guess. But like those communities kind of can sometimes start recommending supplements or diet changes and things like that. So I'm curious if that was ever on your radar.
Not really nutritionally, because my nutrition doesn't change it. I mean, I do remember going to naturopaths telling me they could cure some things of it with supplements, which obviously was not true. It's a chronic lifelong condition. Like, I have had doctors look at me and assume that I don't exercise and I'm not active, which is very far from the case. Like, I'm more active than most of my friends who are able-bodied. It's really important not to make those assumptions about people. I remember one doctor in the past, like, I was having lower back pain and it was because of my wheelchair positioning. And she said, like, oh, if you lost a little bit of weight, it would probably help. And I'm like, no. And then I went to physical therapist and did the exercises, and that got rid of the back. So definitely have been treated differently in the healthcare system.
Yeah. And it sounds like you had a sense of self or a sense of awareness about these things that you were able to say no to that and to not go down that rabbit hole. Was that always with you? Do you feel like you've always been sort of confident in your about your body, or, you know, not concerned about weight in that way?
I wouldn't say that I've never been concerned about weight, but I know that I'm very in tune with my body and with what it needs. Like, I know when, you know, my muscles are tight and I need a massage, for example, or I know when if I'm having some pain, I need to go back to physical therapy, that type of thing. So the fact that I'm very in tune with my body and I know how to advocate for myself and for what I need, that has helped.
Yeah, that's huge. And it's just interesting that you've been going through this for so long and had physical therapy for so long, I wonder if it did help you develop more of a sense of that. Because I know for me, like, I didn't really have any chronic conditions until I was in my 20s. And now I have like a whole slew of them. But, you know, I didn't have that much experience with the healthcare system before that. I mean, on and off when I was sick and stuff as a kid. And I did have a few chronic things, but they weren't the sort of autoimmune and, you know, digestive and hormonal stuff that I have going on now, which is like a whole other level of intensity. So like I had this maybe less intense interaction with the healthcare system, I think. And I really was not aware of my body at all. I feel like I lived very much in my head, very cut off. Even though I did sports and different things, like I sort of would learn about like body positioning in space for a particular sport or whatever, but I was not in tune with like, oh, this hurts, or I need a rest, I need a massage, or I need to like deal with this pain or whatever. You know, I would have stomach aches from just stress and stuff and just be popping Tums all the time and like not really know what else to do with it. So it's just interesting to think about like different ways people can sort of grow attuned to their bodies. And I think that actually developing whatever level of body attunement I have now, which is far greater than anything I experienced younger, I think is related to having all these chronic conditions, really having to like think about them and advocate for myself and keep track of my symptoms and bring them to doctors and talk through them and like see what's working and what's not. And then also having gone through disordered eating in my 20s, like 20s to early 30s, I think also was a way of so intensely disconnecting from my body that the recovery process for so many people, I think recovery from disordered eating inevitably makes them have to get more in touch with their body and sort of stop just trying to entirely live in their head, but actually take more care of themselves and have more self-compassion for what's going on physically. That was definitely my experience, I think, of coming into my body.
Yeah, because I've been going to the doctor since I was born. I guess I was forced to learn how to advocate, and especially because my vascular condition is so rare, like so many doctors have never known what to do with me. So I've just had to advocate. I've had to be in tune with my body and know when I need to go to a doctor. And so, yeah, that's interesting that how your experience started later with your later onset.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, like the different experiences of so many of us with like chronic conditions or disabilities where doctors won't know what to do and sort of what do we do with that? I think for me, when I was initially kind of dismissed by doctors, and also my thing wasn't, you know, my different things, they weren't diagnosed as quickly. Some of them weren't as easily sort of understood, or doctors just also didn't know what to do with me in certain ways, but I didn't have an answer. I wasn't like, well, it's this thing and here's what we do. I was like, yeah, I don't know either. Like, can you please help me? Sort of going from doctor to doctor to try to get answers. And that led me to like be more open to alternative stuff, I think, too. Whereas, I mean, who knows? But I think maybe if I had had more concrete answers more quickly, I could have like shut those doors a little bit more easily.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I've been looking for gifts for my daughter, who's really into science, and I found so many cool things I want to get her. There's an erupting volcano for the bath that has fizzy, colorful lava inside and a little dinosaur, a kit to make frozen bubbles, and my personal favorite, a little stuffed person with removable plush organs in the abdomen, like intestines and a stomach, because she's been really into learning about what's inside our bodies. I love shopping at Uncommon Goods because with every purchase you make, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million so far. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/psych. That's uncommongoods.com/psych for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I
I want to talk about nutritional approaches that are helpful for neurodivergent people because, you know, there's so much unfounded advice out there. There's so much influencer stuff and now the MAHA movement and sort of the way that it just stigmatizes so many forms of neurodivergence. And I'm sure it differs, the sort of nutritional approaches you might use based on the different flavors of neurodivergence. But let's start with just sort of the broad strokes of what role do you think nutrition can play in supporting neurodivergent people?
Yeah, so it's very common in autism, and I would say also ADHD, but more so in autism, to have food aversions to different textures of foods. When I'm working with clients, maybe it's the parent of an autistic child or an autistic adult themselves. Some of them might want to, they want to improve the quality of their diet within their safe food. So the foods that of the textures that they feel comfortable eating. And so I work with them to support that goal. And some of them also want to expand their diet and try new and creative ways to eat foods that they are averse to. So let's say most common is a lot of my autistic clients have an aversion to fruits and veggies, or specific fruits and veggies, because it's a different texture every single time. Like if you think of a strawberry, it could be mushy one time, it could be firm one time, it could be sweet, it could be sour, it could have mold on it, it could be bruised. It's not consistent. You never know what you're going to get. Unlike with a cracker, it's the same reliable texture every single time. So I'll work with them if they want to expand, and I'll work with them to expand and find new ways to increase the nutritional quality of their diet. And I would say also for my ADHD clients, they're often on stimulant medications, which suppress their appetites, and they're really not eating much during the day at all. And as a result, they're feeling tired, and it's harder to focus, which is kind of counterintuitive. And then their appetite comes back at night and their bodies go, oh my gosh, I have not eaten all day. I need to eat everything in sight now. So I work with them to come up with a way to be able to eat consistently during the day so that they have more energy and focus and feel better. And then also interoceptive awareness is a big thing. So people who are neurodivergent, their ability to tell when they're hungry or full is often dulled. And of course, that's even more dulled with stimulant medications for ADHD. So I have training in mindful eating. So I bring in those skills to teach my clients how to become more aware of when they're hungry and when they're full. So that's a big piece.
You know, I definitely talk to a fair number of people just in my work as a journalist and stuff who say, oh yeah, interoceptive awareness, I'm terrible at that. Or I have a really hard time knowing when I'm hungry, or I'll just like start working and look up and hours have gone by and I'm like ravenous, but I don't know what to eat or whatever. How do you help people to start working with that?
Typically, I have them starting to eat more on a schedule. So setting alarms or timers to remind themselves to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner, take that pause from their work and nourish themselves. And then that also helps to stimulate the appetite cues to start to come back. But also, so I have like a worksheet that goes through signs that you're hungry, signs of fullness, and I ask them to identify which ones they connect to. And then I have them practice tuning into it. Because also a lot of times I find it's like we're not paying attention to it. So once we start to pay attention, people often start to notice when they are hungry or when they are full.
Yeah, that was definitely my experience, I think, I was coming at it from a more disordered eating place, but I feel like it's similar with people with disordered eating, actually, you know, that will become very cut off from their hunger and fullness, or those like subtler levels of hunger, and go as long as they can without eating, or try to eat as little as possible or whatever, and then become ravenous later on. And it's like, if we can start working with them to get more attuned to those subtler levels of hunger and take breaks and, you know, think about eating when they're not starving or when it's not like an emergency, that actually helps a lot with sort of bringing that appetite back online and helping them feel more consistently nourished and satisfied and not as kind of up and down throughout the day.
Yes, absolutely.
Are there any like key differences in nutritional needs based on the type of neurodivergence someone might be dealing with? Like, you know, you mentioned a little bit the sort of impact of stimulant medications for ADHD. Are there other things like that that are particular to ADHD or autism that people need to be kind of aware of?
So autistic individuals are more likely to have digestive issues. There's a few different possible reasons for that. So I will often see people who have IBS or constipation, that people with ADHD are at higher risk for eating disorders, particularly binge eating. So I pay attention to that. And I also work with them on dopamine seeking around food and tips for managing that.
Can you explain that a little bit more, what dopamine seeking around food is? Because I think a lot of people might be like, oh God, do I have that?
Yeah. So people with ADHD, their brains don't have as much dopamine, and that's a feel-good hormone. So they're often craving carbs or comfort foods or sweets as a way to like get that stimulation and get that dopamine rush. So, you know, I might recommend like that they include textures that they really crave like throughout the day with their meals, or come up with some alternative ways to get stimulation and dopamine, like exercise or going outside or having fidget toys.
I'm curious too, like the intersection of eating disorders with that, because I'm sure that it can be really tricky for someone who maybe has some of that dopamine seeking tendency, but also is like trying to restrict, or, you know, thinking of themselves as being bad when they're doing the dopamine seeking behavior. Like, you know, how can you sort of navigate that? It's a tricky landscape there.
Yeah. So typically it does come back to making sure they're eating enough during the day, eating consistently, because that is going to help to reduce that quote unquote binging at night. And also to reframe the way that we talk about food or think about food. So I'll often tell clients, we don't need to label it as good or bad. You know, you didn't commit a crime by having ice cream, and having self-compassion and knowing that tomorrow's a new day and it's okay. We can keep going.
Sort of on a related note to that disordered eating piece is like this messaging from diet and wellness culture influencers about neurodivergence, about like, you know, needing to restrict certain foods or certain foods being unhealthy. One of the biggest things I think people with autism or parents of autistic kids are told is to cut out gluten, right? Why is that advice problematic? And how do you work with people who maybe think that they need to cut out gluten or have been cutting out gluten, and, you know, work with them to kind of bring back a more nuanced approach and a more open relationship with food, assuming that they don't also have celiac disease, which means that they would need to cut out gluten?
Yeah, I do often have parents coming to me saying that they've put their 3-year-old child on a dairy-free, gluten-free diet to try to get them talking or improve behaviors. And in the intro call, I tell them, that's not my approach. There is not scientific evidence from large-scale studies to show that it helps. And I find it's even more damaging when the kid is already a selective eater or picky eater. Like, I've seen that also, where it just eliminates so much more that they're able to eat. And then the parents are left with 3 things that they could feed their child. That's one piece, that it just makes their eating even more restricted than it already is. And also it, you know, eliminating the gluten, that takes away a lot of fiber, and the kid might already be struggling with constipation. And then also taking out the dairy, they're often not getting enough calcium, which kids need to grow. You know, their bones are growing and developing. That's also where my neuroaffirming approach comes in, because I don't believe that there's anything wrong with being autistic or having ADHD. And diet cannot cure that. There's no cure for them. I like to embrace neurodiversity and work in a way that works with their brains and not against it. So I don't see neurodivergence as something that's bad or that needs to be fixed. Like I will also get requests of people wanting to change their diet to get rid of their ADHD. And there's no evidence for that.
Right. There's no evidence. And like you said, there's no reason to, because these are just normal forms of human diversity and brain diversity that are something we can accept and celebrate. But I think there's so much in the culture that pushes people to not accept those things and to want to quote unquote cure them. And I think, I mean, we can talk in a minute about kind of the MAHA rhetoric around autism and neurodivergence in general and all of that stuff. But I think it is so problematic. You know, I think in a lot of the wellness discourse around it, there is so much of this underlying idea that we can just cure it and it can go away if only we find this one toxin that's in the environment that's making people have these brain differences or whatever, you know, and they're being seen as this horrible scourge when actually they're just, you know, again, part of normal human diversity. But whenever someone is, you know, looking to kind of change their diet in order to address these conditions, I'm always like, what is the actual goal, right? What's the underlying purpose here? Like another fairly common one that I hear is, you know, that people with autism need to fix their gut health, right? And there is some evidence that people with autism have some differences in the gut microbiome, but the question is why? The sort of MAHA / not neuroaffirming approach to it would be like, well, they're eating too much ultra processed food, or they've been exposed to some toxin that has damaged their microbiome and that caused the autism. So if we can just cut out these foods or find the toxin or whatever, it will fix the microbiome and therefore cure the autism, quote unquote cure, right? And I know when I've looked into the science on this, like any connection to the microbiome is, again, largely based on correlation, not causation. And there's even some evidence that there's some like potential reverse causation in the sense that microbiome changes are actually secondary to a more limited diet that people with autism have due to sensory sensitivities. So the autism pre-exists, right, is these differences in the brain that cause some sensory sensitivities that might create a more limited menu. And one side effect of that can be changes in the microbiome. So it's not like the microbiome really has anything to do with the autism other than just being a side effect of it. I'm curious if you see that in your practice too, like a lot of patients worrying about gut health or wanting to cut out ultra processed foods or having this idea that if they can just like heal the gut, that it can cure the autism or at least like improve behaviors or something.
So interestingly,
that was the first half of my interview with Jackie Silver, and there's lots more good stuff to come. To hear it, become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com or click the link in the show notes. And if you're already a paid subscriber and you happen to be hearing this, look at your welcome email for instructions on how to set up your special podcast feed so that you can get full episodes in your player. You can also just hit reply and someone on my team will help you out. In the meantime, you can find Jackie at jackiesilvernutrition.com. And I want to thank her so much for coming on the show and for this great conversation. If you like this episode, I'd love for you to subscribe or follow Rethinking Wellness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.